From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Hedrick Smith reported from Moscow for the New York Times in the early 70s when it could be dangerous for a Russian to talk to the press. Smith returned to the Soviet Union to make the PBS series Inside Gorbachev's USSR. On today's Fresh Air, Smith talks with us about the new freedoms and new crises in the Soviet Union. Also today, photographer Bert Andrews tells us about documenting four decades of black social life and theater in New York. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews singer Carmen McRae's new tribute to Thelonious Monk. And TV critic David Bianculli previews yet another old sitcom resurrected in a new primetime special. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev declared today that independence moves by the Baltic republics of Latvia and Estonia are illegal. He said that the independence declarations are in violation of the Soviet constitution and the country's new law governing secession of the member republics. There was no indication of what Moscow would do to counter the independence measures. The new government of Violeta Chamorro and pro-Sandinista workers are heading for a showdown in a labor dispute. The new Minister of Labor has taken a hard line on a state workers' strike and issued an ultimatum for their return to work. The workers are demanding a pay increase and protesting the suspension of a law that protected their jobs. Robert Meyerowitz has this report from Managua.
The Nicaraguan Minister of Labor has declared that a strike by public sector employees is illegal and has ordered workers to return to work within 24 hours. Workers at several government ministries in Managua have occupied their offices and refused to let government officials enter. The workers' union is demanding a 200% pay increase to offset a recent series of monetary devaluations. Employees of the Ministry of Construction have blocked the ministry's gates, chanting, "Get rid of them," referring to the new government. In addition to the construction industry, workers have now occupied the ministries of finance and foreign affairs, as well as the National Assembly. In a news conference this morning, the new Minister of Labor reiterated that a return to work is a precondition for any salary negotiations. He said the state would use whatever means necessary to reopen the ministries if the deadline is not observed. For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Meyerowitz in Managua.
The U.S. Supreme Court today refused to lift an injunction restricting anti-abortion groups when protesting Atlanta abortion clinics. Ed Hula reports.
Today's decision by the court rejected an emergency motion by members of the anti-abortion group Operation Rescue, who say their free speech rights are being violated by the injunction. That injunction, issued in March by a Georgia court, prohibits anti-abortion protesters from getting any closer than 50 feet from any facility in Atlanta where abortions are performed. City officials had sought the injunction as a way to put an end to anti-abortion protests that have led to more than 1,300 arrests in Atlanta since July of 1988. The 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court only denies Operation Rescue the emergency relief it had sought. Another challenge to the injunction is under advisement by the Georgia Supreme Court. A spokesman for Operation Rescue vows that if it loses in Georgia, the group will return to the federal courts to appeal. For National Public Radio, this is Ed Hula in Atlanta.
Prices on the New York Stock Exchange hit a record high today, carrying on a surge of buying that began last week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 20 points to close at a record 2,821.53. Advances led declines by a margin of 2-1. This is NPR News. 5 men were arrested today by Canadian authorities in connection with a killing during gambling-related violence on the St. Regis Indian Reservation. Quebec Provincial Police refused to identify the 5 men or the specific charges against them. They're to be arraigned on murder and accessory charges in connection with the May 1st shooting of 31-year-old Harold Edwards. Edwards and another Mohawk Indian man were killed on the same day in gunfire between pro- and anti-gambling forces on the reservation. Since the shootings, Canadian and New York State police have virtually sealed off the reservation, which occupies land on both sides of the border. Police in Fort Worth, Texas, believe robbery was a motive in a multiple shooting at a lounge early this morning. Tracy Tong of member station KERA has this update.
Fort Worth police spokesman Doug Clark says there was a gambling game going on at the Glass Key Cafe at the time of the shooting, possibly involving tens of thousands of dollars. Police have made numerous arrests at the Bar Lounge relating to murder, illegal drugs, and gambling over the last 25 years. 4 to 6 masked men in camouflage burst into the lounge, robbed several of the patrons, and yelled "Task Force" before they opened fire. The men fled in a car. Police say 4 people died and as many as 4 others were injured. For National Public Radio, this is Tracy Tong in Dallas.
Jury selection began today in the securities fraud trial of a stock speculator charged with aiding convicted inside trader Ivan Boesky. John Mulherin is accused of manipulating stock prices and conducting false securities transactions for Boesky. Mulherin, who faces 41 counts of tax, securities, and mail fraud, once allegedly threatened to shoot Boesky for informing on him. Boesky was recently released from prison after serving less than 2 years of a 3-year term and paying $100 million in settlement of securities law violations. Part of his plea bargain included an agreement to act as a government informant. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With Glasnost and Perestroika, American journalists have been given unprecedented opportunities to observe and record Soviet life. Hedrick Smith has taken advantage of this new openness to return to the Soviet Union with a camera crew to document the new freedoms and the new crises under Gorbachev. Smith hosts the 4-part PBS series Inside Gorbachev's USSR. Hedrick Smith was used to the days when journalists assumed the KGB was on their tail. He was the Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times in the early 70s and won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting. His 1976 bestseller, The Russians, was about life in the Soviet Union. I recorded an interview with him a couple of days ago. Smith told me he started reporting for the Times shortly before Khrushchev died. After Khrushchev's death, Smith went on the street hoping to sample popular opinion, as he would for a story in the United States. But the Russians in the street wouldn't be caught talking to the press. During Smith's recent trip to the Soviet Union, Smith and the executive director of the PBS series, Martin Smith, found a dramatic change.
We were just beginning to prepare, do our negotiations, and kind of try out our own relationship and see what we could do. And Marty said to me at one point, he had a mini camera he was taking with me. He said, "Let's go out on the street and do some man-in-the-street interviews." Well, my mind went right back to that experience with Khrushchev's death, and I said, "Well, we'll give it a try, but I'm not sure what's going to happen." I had talked to many Russians in the 70s, but usually privately, personally, developed relationships and that sort of thing. We went out on a bridge across the Moscow River right near the Kremlin along the route that Reagan was going to take for his summit talks with Gorbachev. And I said, "Marty, put the camera down till I get things started." I hadn't spoken the Russian, so I wanted to try out my Russian. Well, he kept the camera up, and instead of alienating people and shooing them away, the camera attracted them, much the same way as it does in New York or Philadelphia or Los Angeles or some city in this country. And the people gathered around, and we started talking, and they said nice things about Reagan, and they hoped he would have good summit talks with Gorbachev. We would have peace between our two countries and so forth. And that was the change. That was the single biggest change for me from the 70s to the 80s. Was the willingness of people to speak out publicly and their dramatic loss of fear of the police state from the early 70s. I can't say the fear is all gone and that everybody was totally candid. That doesn't even happen in this country. But the change was enormous, and obviously it was absolutely vital to the kind of project we were engaged in, which was trying to find the human side of Perestroika and how it was really affecting people, you know, down at the grassroots.
Did you have any reservations about putting people on camera in case Perestroika and Glasnost fall apart and are followed by a crackdown?
In all honesty, I didn't, and I'll tell you why. Back in the 70s, I developed the practice of very early identifying myself to people as a New York Times correspondent. And in some cases, people moved away from me. If I met them in a crowd or at a railroad station or on a train or on an airplane or just had an accidental encounter with them, we'd talk a little bit. And before we got very far into it, I would identify myself as a correspondent so that they were free to exit the situation, to get out of it, to protect themselves. My assumption always was that Soviets know their system better than we do. They know what risks they can take and they're willing to take and what risks they ought not to take.
What's happened to the KGB? I'm sure when you were there in the 70s, there was this constant fear that you were under surveillance and that the people you were talking to might be under surveillance. Is there any fear like that now? Did you ever feel like there was the possibility of being trailed by the KGB? What are they up to now?
Well, let me tell you, it was not It was not an abstract fear in the 70s. I mean, we could hear our phone being tapped. We could watch ourselves being tailed both by car and on foot, sometimes when we were just going over to the grocery store. I mean, it was a very, very real thing, and there were people who told us about incidents that happened to them after we contacted them. So it was very real presence. That, again, is a dramatic and striking difference. Now, that doesn't mean the KGB's gone out of business. What it means is that they've got other things they're worrying about more. They're worried about real spies rather than tailing just general foreigners and journalists as much as they were before. Their manpower is spread thin, but they're still operating. They're worried about labor unrest. They're worried about espionage. They're worried about the border controls. They're worried about bigger national security issues. And, of course, they're continuing with their espionage.
When you were in the Soviet Union, did you see many former hardliners still in governmental positions who had maybe changed their attitude a little bit and you didn't know whether to trust them or not?
Sure. one of the games going on in the Soviet Union today is playing along with perestroika on the surface and sabotaging it underneath. Gorbachev talks about it all the time, about these armies of bureaucrats and party hacks who are sabotaging and undermining, delaying, blockading his program. And of course, when we're going around talking to people who are in positions of power around the country, particularly out in the provinces, we run into them all the time. We talk to the Moscow party boss, Yuri Prokofiev. He made all kinds of nice sounds about how he was trying to help democratize the city. And then when the city actually got a democratic government of non-communist representatives elected in March, what did the Moscow Communist Party do? It appropriated all the city buildings for the city government, saying that they had been built by the party and that they really shouldn't be taken over by the local government. So he was obviously giving democracy a very hard time. There is a real struggle going on in the Soviet Union today at every level of that society, in every walk of life, about whether or not reform is going to move forward or is going to be thrown back. It's going on all the time.
So there must be the sense of not knowing who you can really trust.
Well, Russians basically operate on the principle that they can't trust many people. They operate fundamentally in their public life on the basis of mistrust. But part of what's happened, in all honesty, is that the openness that has been brought by Glasnost has gotten more and more people on the record one way or another. There is an enormous mistrust on the part of the ordinary rank-and-file people for the bureaucracy, for the party hierarchy. And there could even be some good people in the party hierarchy in various different provincial areas, and the public would mistrust them.
My guest is journalist Hedrick Smith, and he's the host of the public television series Inside Gorbachev's USSR. The last program in your series is on nationalism and nationalist unrest in the Soviet Union. Let's look a little bit at the three Baltic republics, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, which have each been campaigning for independence. What have been some of the greatest problems for people in these three republics under Soviet domination?
Well, the suppression of their culture and their national identity. I mean, I didn't find many people in the 1970s who were willing to talk to me about it, but I went to all three republics and I found a few, but it was very risky for them. And sometimes you found people who were simply trying to keep alive Estonian folk art or the Catholic Church in Lithuania. By the way, the archbishop was banned and exiled even within Lithuania and couldn't practice any public services. Or other things in Latvia. I mean, they're just basic nationals, sources of identity and independence, and they felt very Russified. Latvia, today is barely more than 50% Latvian in population, and the reason is that one of Stalin's policies was to move industry into the Baltic republics and with it to move Russian workers, or workers from Russia mainly, but also the Ukraine and Belarusia, from the Slavic republics, and gradually change the demographics within the Baltic republics. And if you notice, there is a difference in the ardency, the vigor with which they pursue independence. Lithuania is the most vigorous, and the reason, in my opinion, is that it's 80% Lithuanian, and Estonia is 60% Estonian, and Latvia is 53% Latvian. So they have to take into account this large minority population that's been moved in.
So what would the Soviets lose if these three Baltic countries were successful in seceding?
I think the most important thing Moscow would lose would be its pride. I think that the notion that a great power would see part of its empire fall apart and fall away from it is a great blow to the Russians as a people, the great Russians, ethnic Russians. Secondly, I think they are very concerned about the military approach to European Russia, particularly with the collapse of the Warsaw Pact. They do have considerable number of troops and installations in the Baltic republics and in a little chunk of Russia around Kaliningrad, which is actually to the west of Russia. So they're concerned about that. I think they're concerned about the danger of the example to other republics. I think they could withstand it. I, frankly, have been a little surprised that Gorbachev, who has publicly recognized that the Baltic republics were forcibly attached to the Soviet Union by Stalin as a result of the Stalin-Hitler Pact back before World War II, that Gorbachev, having recognized this, didn't just say, okay, these three republics are different from the rest of the Soviet Union. They must go through negotiations with us and so forth, but they can actually get independence. He's been pretty tough towards them, and he's clearly trying to hold them in the Union. I think one other thing they'd lose is they feel that they'd lose the most advanced economically, the most advanced part of the Soviet Union. They don't want to do that.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is journalist Hedrick Smith, and he's the host of the PBS series Inside Gorbachev's USSR. Smith was the Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times in the early 70s and is the author of the bestseller The Russians. He's now writing a new book about Russians today. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Hedrick Smith is my guest. There are a lot of Russians that resent the nationalist and independence movements. Why?
Well, part of this is ethnic pride. Part of this is a feeling that others have gotten advantages from Mother Russia. We have to know something about the geography of Russia and the history of Russia today. The Russian Republic is two-thirds of the land area and half of the population of the Soviet Union, roughly 150 million people, mostly ethnic Russians. Now, their claim is that economically they have sacrificed for the rest of the Union. And I think it's probably true if you look at Central Asia or the Caucasus, the republics way to the south and towards Asia. These are underdeveloped areas, and a lot of industry, a health system, an educational system, science, lots of elements of the modern world were built during the 20th century in these republics, and a lot of the money for that came from Russia. And what the Russians are saying is, hey, wait a minute, we sacrificed in years past, in decades past, and these people now want to take the benefits of our investment and leave. That's really not quite so fair with the Baltics, but in any case, that's part of the general Russian feeling. The second thing is there are a lot of ethnic Russians who say that Russia has suffered under the Soviet system, that Russian churches were closed, that Russian culture was suppressed, that the Russian countryside was raped just as much as the countryside and the culture of the Baltic republics or of the Caucasian republics. And they have their rights, too. And right now, they're supplying oil and natural gas and this sort of stuff to the Baltic republics. Why should the Baltic republics, why should the little peoples, the Russians call these other republics the little peoples, why should the little peoples get away with being independent and walking away from the ship when it's sinking? Why shouldn't they have to stick around and fight it out and stick it through with all the rest of us?
How much is the Russian nationalist movement tied to the right wing?
Well, the right wing is part of the Russian nationalist movement, and it's the most vocal, most dangerous, most virulent part, and it's also the part that gets the most attention in the Western press. And That's only natural, but the difficulty is it's a distortion. There are lots of people who are Russian nationalists, that is, people who believe in and want to emphasize Russian culture, music, literature, poetry. Andrei Voznesensky, the poet, and I had a conversation last trip. I was in Moscow, and we were sitting on a park bench talking, and, you know, he said, Chagall, Kandinsky, these great artists of the 20th century, they're all part of Russian culture, as much as Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Chekhov and Tchaikovsky and Rachmaninoff and so forth. I want to emphasize these things, and I want to emphasize the glory of the Russian countryside, not just antagonism towards other nationalities. That's the positive side of Russian nationalism. The negative side of Russian nationalism is anti-Semitic, is anti-Lithuanian, is anti the little people. And the right wing is the most virulent part of it, and Pamyat society, which means memory, is a small but vocal and dangerous element. It's significant, though, to put these people in context. They ran, this extreme right wing, ran its candidates in recent elections this past March. And in Moscow, there were 460 seats up for the Moscow City Council, and the right wing won 10 seats. So they do exist, but they're not a very large portion of the public. And I think their danger is real, but it's been exaggerated by press reports in this country.
I've spoken to several people who've said that glasnost and perestroika in enabling free speech has also freed people up to speak of their hatreds. And it's made anti-ethnic sentiments, anti-Semitism, more virulent than it's been in recent years because people can express it. Do you share that view?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, the lid was on before. And it was very hard for people to say what they thought about anything, good or bad. There certainly was anti-Semitism, and there were you know, real tensions among the nationalities before Gorbachev came into power. But what he did is he took the lid off, and now you can see it. Before you knew it, you bumped into it here and there, but it wasn't anywhere nearly as widely expressed. Now it's right out in the open, and sometimes it's very nasty.
I wonder if you think that the Soviet Union, which is so ethnically and nationalistically diverse, could be ruled in any way besides totalitarianism and keep everybody together.
Well, I don't think that if they are truly democratic that they will keep everybody together. But why should that be the touchstone? I mean, I think that if Gorbachev really allows political freedom and democracy, that the Baltic republics will be gone. But I do think that if you look at the vast population and the largest areas there, as I said before, 150 million Russians, 40 to 50 million Ukrainians, 50 million people living in Central Asia, that's 250 million people. I would guess that body will stay together even if given their choice to separate, at least for another couple of decades and maybe well beyond that. If, and this is very important, there is economic progress and if there is real democracy. One of the dangers that Gorbachev is running now by taking a tough line towards the Baltics is that all the other nationalities are watching and they're drawing a lesson. There's a short-run lesson and a long-run lesson. The short-run lesson is don't challenge Moscow when it's strong and unless you're ready. The long-run lesson is the Russians in the end will suppress the minorities no matter what they say publicly, so get yourself ready for ultimate independence. In other words, if the Kremlin takes too hard a line towards the minority nationalities, their ultimate conclusion will be our only hope is secession, even if that's not what they want to do now. He's building the secessionist movements every week that he takes a hard line with the Baltic republics, because I've talked to plenty of Ukrainians, and very few of them are interested in secession. But if he goes on like this, more and more of them will feel that way. And I think that economic progress, if he can find it, or the Soviet leadership can find it, and greater democracy can hold the bulk of that country together because of achievement, not because of totalitarian repression.
Have you ever met Gorbachev?
Yes.
Is there anything you got from him, any sense of him that you got from him in person that wasn't communicated through hearing about him or seeing him on TV? Any insights you got from actually meeting him?
Well, I think that that any time you meet a leader like that, you get a personal impression of him that, even if you've heard it before, is very different in the flesh. And that is the dynamism, the energy that radiates from this man. And I guess I will never forget the eyes. He has very penetrating, dazzling eyes. They look right through you and at you at the same time. They just convey energy and determinism. I mean, the man radiates an extraordinary magnetism. And even in a brief conversation, you get a sense of this man's absolute self-confidence and his conviction that he can move things forward. And that's terribly important. You sit here in America, and you look at Gorbachev and you say, my God, look at the economy's in the mess. Lithuania and the Baltic republics want to quit. There's violence in the Caucasus, the right wing, the army, the KGB, the right wing of the Communist Party. They're all unhappy. Gorbachev has got to fall. I mean, how many times have we heard the prediction that Gorbachev's going to fall? I mean, there are some people who have been predicting it now for 3 years. Maybe eventually they'll be right. But when you meet the man, one of the things you get is the sense of why he hasn't fallen. And that is the chemistry of him as a person. We keep forgetting that politics has got a lot of personal chemistry to it. And I'm not just talking about the chemistry of a man coming across on the mass media. I'm talking about this man sitting in a little room in the Kremlin with the other members of the Politburo, or talking man-to-man with the head of the defense ministry or the head of the army or the head of the KGB. And the chemistry of his personality affects their attitude and their loyalty towards him. They know he's the boss. He is a man who simply communicates leadership. Now, that's something that you can appreciate physically in his presence in a way that's very difficult to get simply by reading it or even sometimes seeing him move around on television.
What issues will you be addressing in your new book, the one that you're writing now?
Well, I think the fundamental message that I have is this, that there is a process underway in that society which is going to take 20, 30, 40 years to play out. But the change has now got a dynamism and a momentum of its own that will carry on whether or not Gorbachev survives. My thesis is that we spend too much time looking at the headlines and the latest developments of this week or last week without grasping what's going on inside this society. And I think what is happening here is as dramatic and as sweeping and as important as Gandhi leading India to independence at the end of World War II, as Bismarck forming Germany back in the 19th century, as Commodore Perry opening up Japan in 1854. Those events and those trends began in 1 year, and they unfolded over 15 or 20 years or several decades in the case of Japan, and the result had an enormous impact on the world as a whole. That's what I think is going on in the Soviet Union. And that's really basically what I'm going to try to describe in this book, pulling together a lot of the material that you see in the television series, but going beyond it to talk more about how it plays out and the impact on the rest of the world, and to give you a fuller portrait of what I call the new Russians.
Well, Hedrick Smith, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
I enjoyed it, Terry.
Hedrick Smith is the host of the TV series Inside Gorbachev's USSR, which is broadcast Monday evenings on public television. He's now writing a book also called The New Russians. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, actress Barbara Hershey. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bert Andrews chronicles the other New York theater. For four decades, Andrews has been photographing African-American theater, creating pictures that have become important historical documents. Coming up, In the Shadow of the Great White Way. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead considers some new interpretations of the music of Thelonious Monk. And Kevin reviews a tribute to Monk by singer Carmen McRae. And it's a rare 60s sitcom that hasn't limped back onto TV in the past few years, everything from Leave It to Beaver to The Brady Bunch. TV critic David Bianculli previews the latest sitcom, Back from the Grave. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of State James Baker flies to Moscow tonight, looking for ways to make the approaching Washington summit meeting a success. Barry Schweid has more.
Baker would like to nail down an arms control agreement. The highest priority is the START treaty to cut long-range bombers, missiles, and submarines. But widespread disagreement on key issues stands in Baker's way. So President Bush and Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev will have their summit beginning May 30th, probably without a START declaration. Baker planned 3 days in Moscow initially. Even before his takeoff, the visit was stretched to four. The focus, U.S. officials said, will be on arms control. But there is also the tricky situation in breakaway Lithuania, and also agreements on trade, space cooperation, and the environment to whip into shape for summit signings. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
U.S. officials are baffled by a proposition from Soviet officials that President Gorbachev go to Minneapolis in California after the summit in Washington. President Bush had invited Gorbachev to visit his home in Maine, but the Soviet leader turned that offer down, saying that he wanted a business-like summit. The White House today put distance from opposition from the Department of Justice to the Kennedy-Hawkins Civil Rights Bill. Civil rights leader left a White House meeting this afternoon, optimistic about the bill's future. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
The pending legislation seeks to modify or overturn several 1989 Supreme Court decisions that civil rights groups say turn back the clock, specifically on the issue of job discrimination. Attorney General Richard Thornburgh has condemned the legislation, saying it would result in surreptitious quotas. Arthur Fletcher, the head of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, said he told the president quotas aren't the issue here, goals are.
There is no guarantee you'll reach the goal. But all businesses pursue goals, whether it's in the employment arena or in or whatever area. And then you explain, by way of a good faith effort, why you did not reach the goal.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said Congress and the White House have moved closer to something that's acceptable, though there have been no changes in the bill. What appears to be changing is the White House perception about how important this bill is for relations with minorities and blacks. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Thousands of people marched in Paris today in protest to the recent desecrations of Jewish cemeteries. Among those taking part was President Mitterrand in what is believed to be the first time since World War II that a French president had joined a public demonstration. His presence was not announced in advance of the protest. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed at a record high of 2,821.53. The Dow Industrials moved up almost 20 points in very heavy trading of 225 million shares. Advancing issues led declines. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that since the death of Thelonious Monk in 1982, the composer and pianist is more popular than ever. He was the subject of a documentary film released last fall. The movie Round Midnight was named after one of his compositions, and just about everyone in jazz has been recording his tunes. Kevin says playing Monk's music poses a special challenge for musicians. Kevin has some thoughts on how singer Carmen McRae and a couple of other artists handle Monk. Here's Thelonious Monk playing his tune Ask Me Now.
Thank you. Thelonious Monk's writing style was so bound up with his hard, spare piano. A lot of musicians lean toward his quirky sound to do justice to his tunes. One musician who's done that is pianist Tommy Flanagan. Here's his take on Ask Me Now. It's from the tribute album called Thelonica. That approach makes sense to me. Flanagan hints at Monk's angular sound without giving up his own exquisite touch. Musicians who polish away Monk's rough edges tend to miss the point of his music, but there are exceptions, like Carmen McRae on her new album called Carmen Sings Monk. Her smooth treatments focus on the beauty of his melodies. Pianist Eric Gunnison makes no attempt to sound like Monk. Here's McRae's version of Ask Me Now, with lyrics by John Hendricks.
Once you said you loved me, placed no one above me, prayed for me to make that vow. What dumb thing did I say? So busy being blasé, how I wish you'd ask me now.
Those words aren't in the same league as the music, a problem on much of McRae's album. You don't mind if she slurs a few words. Almost half the tracks are ballads. It's not hard for a singer to make them sound good, but Carmen McRae also sings some of Monk's more pianistic lines, which zigzag all over the place. Like In Walked Bud, Monk's tip of the hat to pianist Bud Powell. John Hendricks' lyric imagines Bud at a jam session with, among others, saxophonist Don Byas and bassist Oscar Pettiford, nicknamed O.P.
Shoo-bip, shoo-doo-bip, shoo-doo-dip, shoo-doo-dee-bee-dum-ba-doo-bap, shoo-doo-doo-bee-yum-ba-doo-ba-dum-bam-bum-bum. Dizzy, he was screaming next to O.P., who was beaming. Monk was thumping, suddenly it walked Bud, and then they got into something. Bias blew a mean sax, Mr. Max Roach beat a mean axe. Monk was thumping, suddenly it walked Bud, and then the joint started jumping. Every hipster really dug Bud soon as he hit town. Taking that note, nobody wrote, putting them down. O.P. pulled a mean string, Don and Dizzy played a hip thing. Monk was thumping, suddenly it walked Bud, and then they got into something.
Tenor saxophonist there is Charlie Rouse, who worked with Monk for over a decade. Rouse is only on two live cuts. On the rest of the album, the tenorist is Clifford Jordan. He almost steals the record. He has such a lustrous sound and lyrical concept. Here's McRae and Jordan on Well You Needn't. The lyrics are by Mike Farrow.
You're talking so sweet, well you needn't. You say you won't cheat, well you needn't. You're tapping your feet, well you needn't. It's over now, it's over now. You're dressing with class, well you needn't. You're holding your sass, well you needn't. You think you're a gas, well you needn't. It's over now, it's over now. It's over now, it's over now. You had your fun, so take a bow. You ought to know you lost the glow, the beat is slow, the shadows grow, the lights are low, it's time to go, let's close the show down. You're taking off weight, well you needn't. You're looking just great, well you needn't. You're setting the bait, well you needn't. It's over now, it's over now.
Thank you. Clifford Jordan's dramatic use of space and silence suggests how much he learned from Monk. You don't have to play piano to profit from his example. While McRae pays tribute to Monk's written melodies, Jordan honors his elliptical improvising. Between the two of them, they demonstrate why Thelonious Monk is one of the major forces in jazz, 8 years after his death.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence.
I mean you, one look and I got hurt. Yeah, you wanna hurt me, and I'm glad I sure ain't mad. Who's the one I always turn to? I know who, I mean you.
This is Fresh Air. For four decades, Bert Andrews has been photographing black cultural life in New York, particularly black theater. His theater photographs, beginning with the 1957 production of Dark of the Moon, are reproduced in his new book, In the Shadow of the Great White Way. The book includes pictures of such celebrated actors as Cicely Tyson, Roscoe Lee Brown, James Earl Jones, and Lou Gossett Jr. in some of their earliest roles. Andrews was there to record such important theater productions as Jean Genet's The Blacks, Lorraine Hansberry's To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, Ethel Fugard's The Blood Knot, and Amiri Baraka's The Toilet and the Slave. Currently, Andrews is the photographer for the Negro Ensemble Company in the New Federal Theater. It wasn't until the early 1980s that Andrews began to see his work as valuable historical documents. At that time, he began to take steps to preserve his collection.
I applied to a couple of foundations to try to get grants for fireproof files, which I had just learned about. And a woman came over, and she looked at the stuff and said, well, I don't know if we can give you a grant for this. I don't know that this stuff is really that important. And 2 weeks later, it all burned down.
This was in 1985.
That's right.
Your studio was destroyed by fire. All your photographs?
100%.
What was your first reaction?
Interestingly enough, the very first reaction was kind of a mild shock, you know. Said, well, that's that. I'll start again. I don't know what I thought. It didn't settle in until the next day, because we stood out there watching it burn all night for about 8 or 9 hours. But it didn't settle in until I woke up the next day.
And then?
And then it really, that's when it got me. It was pretty horrible.
So a lot of your friends, people in the theater world, worked to get copies of as many photos as they could, photos that you'd taken to reassemble.
Yeah, a lot of people got together. A lot of people were willing to turn their stuff over to me. Fortunately, most of the stuff that I had done was institutions, mm-hmm. like the Negro Ensemble Company and New Federal Theater and Frank Saver Workshop and Richard Allen Cultural Center, like that. So a lot of that was able to be recaptured, and I'm still recapturing it because it's a slow, tedious process. But an awful lot of it was actors, press agents, who just opened their files to me, that I had worked for in the past. A lot of stuff, and that's how we collected. I'm still collecting, as a matter of fact.
Now you started documenting what you describe as the social life of a segregated city, and black theater. Because you couldn't get work at white publications. I mean,
that's
there was
right.
No official segregation in New York where you lived. But how were you unofficially kept out?
There just was no work. There was no place else to work, no place else to shoot. I started working for the Amsterdam News because there was no place else for me to work at that point in time. We had 7 newspapers in New York City, and not one of them would hire a black. But that's history. That's not even peculiar to me. That's just a fact of life.
What were some of your typical early assignments?
Early assignments. Well, one of the things that I did back in those days was a man named Charlie Banks formed a magazine out of the back of a liquor store on 125th Street. He called it Social Whirl, W-H-I-R-L, the Social Whirl of Harlem. And we covered every week just about every single event that happened in Harlem, social or otherwise. We covered fires. At that time, the Vulcan Society, which was black firemen, got together and formed a society called the Vulcan Society. And we covered the fires they gave us. As a matter of fact, we got the first Vulcan Award for covering those fires and covering those firemen. That was an assignment. We did fashion shows. We had a lot of fashion shows in those days. Political events, church events. I just, whatever happened in Harlem, I covered it.
Were the Harlem fashion shows much different than the shows further downtown?
The fashion shows in Harlem in those days were rather special. Ladies in Harlem in those days didn't go downtown to Saks. They didn't go downtown to Bloomingdale's. They didn't go down to Henri Bendel. And what you had was, you had an awful lot of couturiers in Harlem, dressmakers, ladies who made very fine clothes. They could take Vogue magazine. In those days, it was, Balenciaga. They could take a Balenciaga picture and knock that off for any of their customers, you know? Those fashion shows in Harlem in those days were spectacular. Those ladies were dressed to the nines.
Do you have any copies of these photos anymore? The fashion shows,
they
the Vulcans?
They don't exist.
Mm.
They all went down with the flame.
That's really heartbreaking.
And I had a complete set, of course, of the Social Worlds, complete set of Our World magazines. They all went down with the fire. Yeah. And I wouldn't even know where to begin to recollect those.
What got you started photographing theater?
What got me started photographing theater? I was dating an actress who got her first role in Dark of the Moon. And she got me the job photographing this show. And out of that show came, out of that play came Cicely Tyson, Roscoe Lee Brown, Clarence Williams III, Louise Stubbs, Dick Ward, all of these people who later went on to become names and stars in the theater. And it was their first time on stage.
Now, you started photographing while you were in the Army, but you say that it was more of a hustle than a hobby. What was the hustle?
Well, I was in the Army, and it was a hobby. So the guys, all the guys wanted pictures to send home to their loved ones, you know? And so I was running around in my spare time taking pictures of the guys and hustling pictures.
How much did you charge them?
Oh, God, I don't remember now. I think it was a dollar.
That's not bad.
A dollar and a quarter, something like that. Well, it didn't cost me anything. I mean, the Army supplied all the materials.
Uh-huh.
You know, I had bought this camera in Germany, this little camera, and all I had to do was go into the service. I ran my business out of the service club. So it cost me nothing, so they got them very, very cheap. And after a while, they started looking for me. They would come looking for me to take pictures of them in their uniforms to send home. And the officers would give me a special time to go into the dark room and stuff. So it was great. That's how it started.
There was one day when you woke up nearly blind because of diabetes.
Oh, I didn't know that. Is that in the book?
Well, I read it about you. It might have been in an article.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, yes, that is true. I woke up and I couldn't see, and I panicked because, of course, that's what I'm all about. If I can't see, I'm out of business. But I have a fabulous doctor who got me straightened out in short and very quick time, and I'm in very good shape now. And as a matter of fact, this is sort of, I hate to say this, but I hate these mixed blessings. All of these things are mixed blessings. People of my age who acquire diabetes at a late age probably get an extra 10 years over most other people, because one of the reasons you get diabetes is because you've been living badly, you've been mistreating your body health-wise, and then suddenly you have to take care of yourself, and you live better than most people do suddenly. You begin to take better care of your body than most people do, so it's kind of a mixed blessing. I probably live at this point 10 years longer than I certainly would have if I had not discovered that I had it.
You told us at the beginning of our conversation that it was only recently that you really came to see your photographs as a documentation of recent history.
Yeah, recently meaning the 80s, you know. Meaning, you know, like 83, 80, 84, like that.
Oh, right, right, that it was around 83 or 84 that you started to see it that way, right. Now when you go to take photographs, are you self-conscious thinking that, you know, in a few years, in a couple of decades, that these photographs will have important historical value as documentation?
Yeah, that's kind of in the back of my head now, you know. It really is.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing to have in the back of your head when you're taking a photograph?
It's another mixed blessing, because it can get in your way, you know. But what I decided to do and what I have done is, and primarily because there is very little time, okay? When you get a picture call, a director has given you some time to take these pictures, and he's jealous of that time, so you don't get a whole lot of it. So you don't have time to piddle around and get involved with his history and all that stuff. You got to get in there and get your pictures and get the hell out, because the director's sitting there patting his foot. He needs that time. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand exactly what you're saying.
So while I'm also conscious that it's historical and that they're going to be very important, and I want to make sure that I've gotten everybody, and that I'm, you know, I do a little bit more now than I used to do when I would go out on the picture call, but still, you just don't have the time to do it, so you do what you have to do.
Well, Bert Andrews, thanks a lot for talking with us about your pictures.
Oh, thank you.
Photographer Bert Andrews, his new book is called In the Shadow of the Great White Way, Images from the Black Theater. It's published by Thunder's Mouth Press. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. The Supreme Court hears arguments about the desecration of the American flag. We'll have more on the budget battle from Capitol Hill. We'll talk with a professor at Jackson State University in Mississippi. He was a witness 20 years ago to the shootings by police of two young people on the campus there during a night of protests following the tragedy at Kent State. He maintains there was no justification for the police to be opening fire at Jackson State. And NPR's Ted Clark reports from Mozambique, where it's estimated that about 250,000 children have been separated from their families because of civil war. Ted will follow the story of one young boy and efforts to reunite him with his family.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Friday night, CBS is revisiting one of its old shows, a show most baby boomers will remember, but a show which television critic David Bianculli says we should all try to forget.
While other networks are forging ahead with new ideas like Twin Peaks and The Simpsons, CBS is stuck in the past. Already this season, CBS has presented The Love Boat, A Valentine Voyage, and The Return of Sam McLeod, and Gunsmoke, The Last Apache, two old I Love Lucy shows, a bunch of new candid camera specials, and, speaking of bunches, an entire series devoted to the Bradys. Which show from the 60s is coming back to haunt us this time? Remember Lost in Space? Well, that's not the show that's coming back. But do you remember the robot and what he used to say whenever something really terrible was about to happen? Warning, warning, danger, danger. I feel like saying it right now because this TV movie is really terrible. Ready? Here we go. That's right, Green Acres. And for this new movie, cleverly called Return to Green Acres, they start things out with some new lyrics.
Seems time has just been rolling on. Made a lot of friends who've come and gone. Some things change as years go by. On other things you know you can rely.
I never thought you'd hear me say, milking cows is how I start today.
We're happy with this life we've found. Who needs a city? I've got some solid ground.
The first 10 minutes of Return to Green Acres are the most painful ones to watch because they stir up memories that most of us have successfully suppressed for nearly 20 years. Like, for instance, Alvy Moore as Hank Kimball.
Good morning, Mr. Kimball. Beautiful day, isn't it?
Well, not beautiful. More like fair. Well, not really fair. Well, it isn't unfair either. Something in between fair and beautiful, sort of fairful.
And, of course, those inane conversations between Oliver and Lisa Douglas, played once again by series stars Eddie Albert and Ava Gabor.
Lisa!
Be right there, darling.
Oh, hey, guess what? My alfalfa's in full bloom. Bottom 40's a sea of green as far as the eyes can see. Oh, alfalfa!
That's wonderful news. But what are we going to do with all that falafala?
Oh, alfalfa. It's fodder for the animals.
Oh, darling, I'm so proud of you. And maybe next year you can grow the mudder.
I'll spare you the rest. Take it from me. The only people who don't show up for this reunion are the Ziffels, who used to own Arnold the Pig. Otherwise, everyone is shown wasting away in Hooterville, including Arnold, who goes to New York and stands in line to see Pygmalion. Pygmalion. Yep, it's that kind of show. It's worth remembering that Green Acres came after the Beverly Hillbillies, which was all about country folk moving to the city. Viewers flipped over that idea, so CBS flipped the idea and came up with Green Acres, which was all about city folk moving to the country. So midway through Return to Green Acres, when the Hooterville residents visit New York City, it's natural to ask the question, how unoriginal can you get? The answer is very. And that answer applies not only to Return to Green Acres, but to CBS. Arnold the Pig could root out better program ideas.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblitis, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We meet two actors on the next Fresh Air. Barbara Hershey talks with us about her roles in A World Apart, Hannah and Her Sisters, Beaches, and The Last Temptation of Christ. And John Mahoney tells us how he started acting in his late 30s. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.